I could have, where's group number one? Where's group number two? Where's group number three? Great. Group number four? Group number five? Fabulous. Group number six? Congratulations. Okay, so let me just give you, wait a minute, Mike. Let me give you some reminders. The first thing is that this is an exam. And so that means that I want you to try and cut the strategizing down and pay attention to everybody. And there might be a lot of surprises here, so be prepared for surprises like there was on the last oral exam. The second thing is that you are in groups, so there's no reason for any of you to really feel undue anxiety. You have the help of the people in your group. So try and look at this as a really positive learning experience, but also try and show what you really know. I think that's important. Third thing is, remember, everyone has to participate, so you have to pass the microphone from person to person. And then no notes, no written out anything. You have to come in absolutely clean. And I know that it's hard to really do, but those of you that go first kind of have an advantage on those that go last, depending on how you look at it, because the people who go last have to wait, and so therefore please, you know, pay attention, because you never know where you might be an honorary member of the group. So keep that in mind. And then those of you that are going last, there's really no strategizing along the way. The 15 minutes that I'm going to give you in about 2 seconds is all you have to organize your answers, and that's it. So don't be talking among yourselves and all of that. And the final thing is, make sure that you do a potty break before we assemble back in the room, because we're not going to be taking a break during the hour and a half that we'll be having the oral exam, because we can't, because there's a class that comes right in here afterwards, so we don't have the luxury of time like we have in other times, okay? Does anyone have any questions about anything? Anton.
Can you write down our answers as we discuss it for the group during the 15 minutes?
Yeah, but don't bring it into the exam.
Okay.
I mean, you can write what you want to do, of course. I mean, of course you can strategize and outline and do whatever you want, but don't bring it in with you. Of course, absolutely. That's essential. Yes, Matthias. I mean, God, Mazzeo. That's okay. Go ahead.
Are you going to explain how the challenge is going to work?
Yeah, okay. Good question. So we have the answer group and the challenge group. And after the answers are done, the challenge group should have thought about 2 or 3 succinct, direct, precise questions. And you can direct them to a specific person in the group or the group as a whole. And then the group will answer the question. And if there's a follow-up question, then it's another member of the challenge group. If there's a follow-up question, it's another member of the challenge group. So the challenge group, you want to have kind of like the answer group, where you spread your questions through the group. Now, you have only 8 minutes to answer your question, and you have only 4 minutes for the challenge. So it's part of this exercise is really organizing what you want to say and being succinct about it. You know, we know a lot of the details among all of us, and it's the conceptual things that you really want to flesh out as much as possible. Okay, we are going to use timers. So on your answer question, the timer is going to go off at 6 minutes. And then you're going to have another 2 minutes, and then it's going to go off at 8, and that's it. Okay? And then we go into the challenge question. Anything? One more, and then we got to go. Brian?
So is it part of the challenge group, like in the same group that you're in, or I'm a little bit lost about
challenge group is in the same group that you're in. Okay, so you'll draw two questions. You're going to draw an answer question and a challenge question. So you're both in the same group, as you'll see.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So you're all working together on both aspects of it. Is it clear? Okay. Hinaro, how are you? God. shocking me. Gennaro is from Brazil. I haven't seen you in a while. Believe it or not, he used to be a TA in this class in 1991 when it was called Genetic Engineering. Did you just get off the plane? Oh, my God. Anyways, welcome. So let's pick the questions. Group number one. Challenge and answer. Yeah. Okay, let's not, no talking.
Am I doing it?
Let's go. Group number one, challenge, answer. Group number two.
So group one is challenge number three.
We'll go through it. Group number two. Challenge and answer. Okay, group number three. Challenge and answer. And if you get the same one, you got to put them back, obviously. Hold it, guys. T, please. It's an exam. Thank you. Group number four. Where's group four? Challenge and answer. Exam, guys. Nico, thank you. Group number five. Challenge and answer. Group number six, challenge and answer. Remember which color is which. Challenge and answer. Remember which one's which? Okay, so let's go through this. Group number one, what is your answer question?
Number four.
Group number one, what is your challenge question? Group number two, what is your answer question? Group number two, what is your challenge question? Group number three, what is your answer question? Group number three, what is your challenge question?
Seven.
Group number four, your answer question.
Five.
Group number four, your challenge question.
Six.
Good. Group number five, your answer question.
Seven.
Group number six, five, your challenge question.
One.
Group number six, your answer question.
One.
Becca, your challenge question, group number six. Group number seven, your answer question. Group number seven, your challenge question. Okay, now, keep in mind, those of you that got questions number one and two, these are the quiz and the take-home fail-safe questions that you haven't seen. But now, as you assemble into your groups to prepare your questions, here are your questions. So why don't you just distribute them? And then assemble into your groups, go outside, scatter, and we're coming back at exactly 5 minutes to four to begin the exam. Gloria, can I have a copy of that? Don't bring the notes back in the classroom. Okay, hold it. Hold it till the questions are given out. Those of you who have question one for the answer, you have your quiz fail-safe question. Those of you that have question two, you have your take-home fail-safe question on the answer. Keep that in mind. Does everyone have a copy of the exam? Okay, break. I want to see you back no later than 5 minutes to four, and please go to the bathroom before you come back.
I printed out the original copy and it was correct, but then I guess it
what happened?
Quickly.
Instead of being like
it's
that.
Supposed to be spread out. So I was gonna run back and print it again.
I'm lost.
So it doesn't really matter
spread
though.
Out. But then look, when you write Sammer's grade for the
yeah,
actual grade,
whatever you want to do,
okay.
That's fine. But let me keep this because it's a record.
Yeah, don't worry about it. I think it'll be fine. We can just write along. As long as we write it along here, we'll be fine. But this is the group grade, isn't it?
It's good.
Yeah.
This is just the
group
grade. We can do it. Don't worry about it.
Okay.
There's only one number in the baseline.
Hinaro! Okay. Everybody ready? Let's roll. Guys, you know, the first time I ever talked, first time I ever was a professor, I was this young 27-year-old guy, and they just had this newfangled invention called a wireless microphone. And I was really, 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 really nervous. So halfway through my lecture, I had to run to the bathroom. But I had forgotten to turn my wireless microphone off. And it was a class of about 300 students. And it was the loudest, strongest ovation I ever got when I came back into the classroom. Okay. Where's group number one? Raise your hands high. Where's group number two? Everyone's here? Daisy's in the bathroom, okay. Where's group number three? Group number four? Four around? Where's five? Six? Okay, now remember, this is supposed to be fun. Okay, really, it's 10 weeks, you gotta show what you know. So think it out. Has everyone had a pit stop and no one's running anywhere? Or David, you're okay? Redina's coming back. Yuditha,
yeah.
You ready to roll?
Yes, we're just
fine. Samantha, you ready to roll? Sky, you ready to roll?
Like 2 seconds.
Patricia, you ready to roll? Jessica, you ready? Charles, Heather, Nick, Ben, Becca, Daisy, Mizael, Anton, Sommer, you ready? Kyle, A, you ready? Jordan, are you ready? You're boning up there. You're not supposed to be doing that. T, are you ready? Ryan, are you ready? You awake? Chris, you ready? Brian, you ready? Lisa, what are you doing? Huh? You ready to roll? This is one of your last exams. We got to have an applause for Lisa because she graduates. It's her last class. Radina, are you ready? Jennifer, you ready? Kyle? Did you know Kyle lived on a boat for 3 years? Sailed around the world with his parents? Isn't that interesting? You ready, James? Karina? Najla? Hannah, remember the first time I called you in class about 10 weeks ago? Loda, you ready? Shauna? Well, the bad news is you have to go through this exam. The good news is you don't have to face any questioning by me anymore in a couple hours. So that's the good news. Okay. So let's begin. Is the timer ready?
Yep.
Okay. Let's go. Remember how random it was last time? Let's start with question number one. The quiz fail-safe. So who has question number one? What group? Group six has the question. So the answer is group six. Who has the challenge? What's your group? Group five. Okay. So this is a question that deals with plant genetic engineering and the history of recombinant DNA. And so you have pens here. Use the board. You know, take your pens, use the board, the diagram, whatever you need to diagram out. Okay, here's some more. Here's the red. Here's the green. Go ahead, Brian. Pass them around. You have two boards if you need them. And this is dealing with a quiz number three and number one. Two quizzes together is a fail-safe. So you now have 8 minutes, and the buzzer will go off at 6, to start with a plasmid and come up with a genetically engineered plant that makes something a clotting factor in all of its cells. So shoot.
Okay, so you are starting out with two plasmids, X and Y, and you have to make a recombinant plasmid. So first you cleave the plasmid X at the E. coli 1 site with a restriction enzyme, and you take out the human clotting factor 8 cDNA clone. And with that, you also use the same restriction enzyme to cut the Y plasmid at the E. coli 1 site between the on and off switches, and you take that first human clotting factor cDNA that you take out, that you cleaved, and you cleave it at the site that was cut in the Y plasmid, and then you let it anneal and ligate. After the Y
plasmid has been engineered, we basically put the plasmids on pellets, on the surface of the pellets of, because the question states that we would use a particle gun capable of shooting the DNA directly into the nuclei of cultured plant cells, and then we would basically shoot it at like
talk to the class, Brian.
We would shoot it at like a plate of plant cells, and hopefully, and basically cross our fingers that the DNA would be incorporated into the plant cells. And how do we know whether or not it actually has incorporated? Actually depends on whether or not it is resistant to cantamycin, which is an antibiotic. Now it will be part B. Very short.
Thank you, Brian. So, the importance of our work to medicine and human health is primarily the fact that hemophilia is a disease from which people can die, and we can use our transgenic plants to generate a drug that will treat people and allow them to live, allow them to have a better quality of life that they might otherwise have.
The advantages of using plants to produce the drugs is that you could cut down on transportation costs, because in other countries or all around the world, you could just grow the plants there and it would be there and you wouldn't have to transport it. And also, you would just, it's easy to like take, because you just have to eat the plant, and then instead of like injections and things like that, because when you inject, your needles might be infected and you could get infections that way.
And then transgenic plants can help farmers in a number of ways. First of all, they can reduce the number of pesticides and insecticides and fertilizer that farmers use, because they would just require less amounts. For example, with BT corn, BT is an insecticide, and farmers will no longer have to spray anything on the corn. That saves time and money, because farmers don't have to go out in the field and they don't have to pay for the gas for the tractors or for the farmhands that would have otherwise done this work. So it can save farmers time and money. And for the small amount of people that are affected by being exposed to large doses of pesticides and other such chemicals throughout the year, it would also help their health.
And last, to ensure that the tobacco plants are safe for both humans and in the environment, first, like before you bring it out to the crops, you probably want to do lots of like tests and stuff in the laboratory before you bring it to the field. And also to prevent like transferring the genes by like spores or pollen in the air and stuff. You don't want to plant similar species of the plant close to your crops, and you probably want to put like non-genetically engineered plants near these genetically engineered plants so that you would have more variety in case anything happens.
Okay. I want to talk a little bit about how we're going to try to mitigate the hazards of this recombinant DNA technology. In 76, we implemented these biological and physical containment levels. To speak conceptually about them, right, the physical containment levels go from basically working in lab coats when we're working with something safe and pretty manageable to working in big spacesuits with the bacteria contained so that they're not getting out anywhere, right? These are the physical containment levels. We have the biological containment levels, which stipulate the kinds of bacteria that we're allowed to use. For relatively safe kinds of experiments, we use bacteria that are fairly common strains of E. coli. For something pretty pretty dangerous. We use E. coli that are bred specifically to not survive outside of the laboratory. So if something goes wrong with our physical containment, something gets out, we're not going to be too worried about their surviving and infecting the population. These guidelines are not directly legally enforced. They are, however, indirectly enforced via the granting of giving grants to laboratories, right? So part of writing up, I don't know if you recall from this quiz, but we had to write up a little description of how exactly we're following these containment levels, and if we weren't, for some reason, we wouldn't be given money to give our experiments. So this is an indirect regulation of science.
The 1970s were a pretty wild time, and not a lot was known about recombinant DNA. E. coli is a bacteria that lives in the gut of human beings. Therefore, if something potentially went wrong with recombinant DNA, people were afraid that it could unleash the fiery pits of hell upon humanity. And in order to prevent against that, some people advocated maybe banning recombinant DNA. Constitutionally, this would be adjudicated to the brilliant preamble of the Constitution, which states that what we have in mind is the promotion of the general welfare of the people, the populace of the United States of America. So under that section of the preamble, this potentially could be allowed to mitigate some huge disaster, or if everyone got sick. And lastly, Amendment 10, or Article 10 of the Constitution, specifically states that that which is not delineated for the federal government is passed on to the state and local level, or to the people. So that would give the city or a town or a council or whatever the right to act with what they thought was within their best interest and potentially stop a terrible genetic disaster, which people thought might happen because not a lot was known at the time.
And, challenge.
Wait,
go ahead. Okay. Got 1 minute.
Microphone,
turn it on, Jennifer.
To add on to Part B, where you want to make sure that it's safe for the environment and people, there's also guidelines set by the FDA and the USDA and the EPA that we forgot to add. But now we did.
Challenge group. Group number 5. You have 4 minutes.
Is the DNA gun the most efficient way of doing this process?
Absolutely not, because it's not. We have because of the fact that we're not really quite sure, like how efficient it would, or no, not how efficient, how accurate the gun would be, because the way the gun shoots is pretty much like a shotgun. So it's not like a sniper rifle where we just kind of have a crosshairs and it will hit there all the time. So it's not the most efficient way. The most efficient way would be probably to go use like an agrobacterium per se, and where it would actually go in and directly modify the actual plant cells, and that would be the surefire way of doing it.
Next question.
In section A, you cut a piece out of a plasmid and put it into another one. What are the specific properties of DNA that might allow you to do that between species?
Okay, well, the specific properties of DNA that allows it to be passed on from one species to another is first of all, it's universal, excuse me. And by being universal, it means that it's, you know, found in all species. Second of all, it can be replicated. So it can be replicated in the first species, it can be replicated in the second species. And third of all, it's a stable molecule. So those are the three facts that allow it to be used in different species.
And then a follow-up to that question, what particularly about the plasmid that you use as the vector allowed for that particular gene to be expressed in that cell?
Because there was the site that you recut with the restriction enzyme, there was a on switch and an off switch, then also which allowed it to be active in all plant cells and organs.
Another question?
That's kind of my question. Why would you use plasmid Y instead of
two more minutes.
X?
Well, it's just the way the problem was phrased. It said that the plasmid Y had the gene transcript, like it had the on and off switches. So basically, With it saying that the on switch allowed it to be active in all plants and cells, basically opened the door for us to be able to say, okay, look, we want, if we put this in our target plant, it will automatically have it on the whole time. And that's why we use plasmid Y instead of plasmid X. The switch was there, basically.
My question is not about so much the science, but in Part C, the 1976 research guidelines mitigates the potential hazards. Do you believe that any of these hazards have or have not been realized today, 30 years after the guidelines were put in place?
We would like to say the guidelines were prudent because we didn't know what was going on at the time, but it seems that no, the fears certainly have not been realized that were voiced at the time and that were responsible for the implementation of the guidelines.
I'd also add that because these are really expensive projects, the fact that you needed to get a grant cut out a whole section of scientists that couldn't do it, so it was probably a prudent thing to do, and I agree with my colleague.
Any other questions?
I'd like to add one more thing. I don't know if you recall, but just to let you know specifically, the guidelines are go under the abbreviations P1 through 4 and EK1 through 4. And we have not used for either at the physical or the biological levels.
And what would you have used for these plant experiments?
So it would have been something like, something like 1 or 2, because these are not genes that would be easily transmitted into humans or anything like that.
Great job. Fantastic job. That was just superb on both ends. So let's think about what question we're going to have next. Maybe we'll go from the back. Let me see. How about question number 2? So what's the answer group?
Number 2.
And what's the challenge group? Challenge group on question 2? 7. Set the timer, please, Mike and Gloria. So this is a question that deals with the identification of human disease genes. And you are given a pedigree. And that pedigree, we could put it on the board, but if you want to draw it, go right ahead. You only have to draw the critical stuff, Daisy.
Yeah.
So we have a pedigree, and it deals with a human disease gene, and the idea is to find the gene, find out what's going on, the mode of inheritance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you now have group number 2, 8 minutes.
All right. I am working with parts A and B of this question, which are basically asking, is this disease caused by a dominant or a recessive gene? And then in part B, explain your logic. So basically, it's caused by a dominant gene, and you can do Punnett squares, which my colleague is doing here. Thank you. And basically, it has to be dominant because this is if it was dominant. And if it was recessive, then to have it, both of these two here would have to be homozygous recessive, because otherwise there's no way it could be expressed. And in which case, the only thing they have to pass on, the only alleles they have, would be recessive. And that means both of their offspring would have to be expressing the trait, which they're not. So that's it.
Okay, I'm going to do part C, and Daisy's going to diagram for me. I can do this. So we want to construct a human genome library. And we're going to start with white blood cells, and we're going to extract the DNA from the white blood cells. And we're going to partially digest that DNA so we get overlapping fragments. We're going to use a lambda viral vector in this for this library, as a vector, obviously. And we're going to cleave.
What's your major, Becca?
Poli-sci.
Yeah, go ahead.
And we're going to use the same restriction enzyme to cut out an area of this lambda virus that is not needed for replication. And then we're going to anneal the fragmented DNA and the lambda viral DNA together and seal the phosphodiester bonds with DNA ligase. And then we're going to package it together in a virus, and we're going to use E. coli cells, and we're going to infect the E. coli cells with the virus, and the E. coli cells are going to break open, or the E. coli cells are going to break open due to the virus, and what's going to result are called plaques. And each plaque is going to contain a specific clone that's in our library, and we want to identify the clone or part of the clone that contains the CLOT1 gene, and we know the N-terminal amino acid sequence, so we can construct a probe that's complementary to that, and we can screen our library to determine part of the CLOT1 gene. And part D?
Yeah, I'm going to be doing part C, which, D. which, once you identified the 5-end of the CLOT1 gene, it asks you how you would identify the rest of it and the rest of the clones. And you would do this through the process known as chromosome walking. So because you have the 5-end of the CLOT1 gene, that means that because you partially digested the DNA fragments, you're going to have overlapping regions. So because you have the 5-end?
5' end.
5' end. You're going to have other sections of DNA in other plaques. So you would use the end of the 5' end that you have as a subclone, and you would go back to your original plaque and rescreen for other sections of it. And then once you rescreen for it, you're going to find the overlapping region of the first part, which allows you to find the next extension of the gene. And then you would do that subsequently to the other ones. And you would eventually reach the end, and the way that you know that you reached the end, you wouldn't really know without going back into the tissues that you originally extracted the CLOT1 genes from, the blood. So you would need to find the cDNA for it from the mRNA, so that you know that because it has no introns or exons, you can see the definite end to it, and then you can compare that to your gene to see where the end is, and that's how you would do that.
Guys have learned. How much time? Go ahead.
In part E, you're trying to find a marker. So what you can do is isolate the gene from both normal and mutant alleles, and you sequence the whole, both of them, to find the single nucleotide difference between the two. And after you find the SNP, then you can find which restriction enzyme would cut one of them at an extra site in comparison to other.
Okay, and in that case, if we cut both fragments with that enzyme, they will show up on the gel as two stripes as opposed to one, which would indicate that if, let's say, the healthy gene does not have a site, but the mutant one does, then the probe of the mutant one is going to have two stripes and not one. And the way we'll make a marker is we just make a probe that's complementary to the long strand that does not get cut by the enzyme.
Last part?
So in the last part, basically what it's saying is that the mutant causes a deletion, I guess, of restriction site. I don't know if that's a good word to use, but basically a restriction site is missing. So what happens is because one is missing, there's going to be a longer fragment, and when you pass it through the gel, it won't travel as far down because it's longer. So the diseased person will have a longer fragment up here, and it will result in the following pattern.
Is that diseased individual heterozygous or homozygous that you drew?
Homozygous. Well, the diseased individual is heterozygous.
Okay. And that, good. Yeah. Challenge.
What are the properties of viruses that would allow you to use them as a vector?
Good question.
What a virus does is it injects its DNA into the cell, and that allows,
the DNA from the virus gets incorporated into the genome of the cell, which it infects.
And also, because the virus is aiming at replicating itself, it's going to go into the host cell and replicate itself eventually so many times that it's going to cause the cell to explode. And that's why you get the plaques, because those specific E. coli cells have died.
How does the virus bind to the cell? How does it find and bind to the bacteria cell that you want it to infect? What is it specifically looking for?
The virus is looking for surface proteins on the outside of the cell, and it recognizes them, and that's where it attaches.
Okay, what does the RFLP marker give rise to, and how?
It gives rise to a restriction site that is present on one of the alleles, but not on the other one? Like, let's say if we're testing healthy versus mutant. How? Because there's a different sequence, and in a mutant one, the sequence accounts for a restriction site, and the healthy one, it doesn't. So you can tell between the two genes when you run those in a gel.
Next question.
For part E, how exactly do you figure out which restriction enzyme is going to be the one you use to determine the RFLP marker?
If you have the sequence, you can just put it in the computer program that's going to pick out all the possible restriction sites for you. We've done it on the quiz. And
there's another method besides the sequencing method, and in that case, you just try a combination of restriction enzymes and probes and hope that you come upon something that would serve as a marker for this disease.
One last question.
When you were talking about finding the end of the gene, you said you construct cDNA from the mRNA for the enzyme. How do you find that mRNA?
Well, actually, you just go back to your own blood cells and you find the mRNA that creates the hemoglobin gene. And then you from that protein, you go back to the RNA and then you use reverse transcriptase to create a cDNA clone from that. And you can sequence that cDNA clone to find the end of that DNA. So you can actually find the end of the long strand.
Great job. Let's move on. Fantastic. God, I'm so proud of you guys. You really learned a lot. What's going on, Mike? Okay, you're in exam. Jordan? Brian? Thank you. No preparing or anything. Kyle? Remember the rules. Okay, let's start going randomly now. We've now covered the fail-safe of the quiz, the fail-safe of the take-home test. And so now let's go on to the oral exam questions that you had for a week and that you've been able to prepare. And again, let's try and do this a little bit more randomly. So let's go to question three. Who's got question number three? What's the answer group?
Seven.
Okay. Answer is group number seven. Who's the challenge group?
One.
Challenge group is number one. Okay, now remember, you're in exam, so no preparing, and you could be honorary members at any moment, so keep that in mind. Okay, this deals with a bacteria that's able to eat flesh, and the idea is to try and understand what the gene is that's responsible for this pathology, and then to find a drug which will counteract it and to patent the drug, and so it deals with both science and law and a variety of other things. So you have the timer, Mike?
Yeah.
Got it?
Yep.
You have 8 minutes.
Okay, so you start off with the...
So what's the part that you're doing?
I'm doing A for question
and
three.
And what is it?
And you want to construct a flesh-eating bacteria genome library.
Okay.
Okay, so you start off with the bacteria DNA, you isolate it, and then you partially digest that, so you're going to get fragments of DNA. And you're going to use the HIND3 restriction enzyme, which cuts at the beta-galactosidase site on the plasmid, and that's important for later. And basically, you're going to get a plasmid like this if it's recombined, and these fragments are inserted here. So then you make the bacteria semi-permeable transformation, and you get three different types of bacteria in your culture. One of them will have the recombined plasmid with the ampicillin resistance here. One of them will not be recombined, and it'll still have ampicillin resistance, and the other one won't even have a plasmid. So your culture is going to contain ampicillin, which will kill this one, and it's also going to have an X-gal substrate, which... when this bacteria gets that, it turns blue because it has the gene for beta-galactosidase. And this one will be white because the gene was interrupted. So you basically choose for these, the white ones, and that's your library.
Okay.
I'm doing part B, which is to determine how many pieces you would need. So we're given the information that the nucleotide sequence has 80% C's and G's. And if it has 80% C's and G's, that means that you know it has 20% A and T, because the remaining percentage is going to make up the other two nucleotides. And if you know that, well, if you know that 80% is C and G, then you know that 40% of those are going to be G and 40% of those are going to be C, because they have to, they pair up together, so they're going to be half and half. So now we're trying to figure out how many section pieces you would need. This is your sequence, so you want to figure out what's the probability that the sequence as it is going to exist in your DNA. So if you know that G occurs 40% of the time, then the probability of getting a G nucleotide is 0.4. If you know that A is going to occur 10% of the time, because 20 divided by 2 is 10, then you know the probability is going to be 0.1. You keep doing that for each of the nucleotides. And when you multiply those out together, because you want to find out the probability of getting this specific sequence, you're going to get 1.6 times 10 to the negative 5. Now, it tells you that there are a million base pairs, there are a million bases, tells you that there are a million bases in your sequence. That's information that you're given. And so now you want to find out how many times is this particular site going to show up on a strand of DNA that's long, that is that long. So you multiply by a million, because that's how many bases there are, and you get 16, which means that your restriction site is going to show up 16 times on this particular sequence. And that means that you're going to get 16 pieces, because the DNA is circular, so you have as many pieces as you do cuts.
Fabulous. Mm-hmm. Next part.
I'm doing part C, where starting with the library, how we need to find which gene contains the, which section contains the gene for the flesh-eating enzyme. So we have all our colonies of the clones, and so we extract them, we lyse them, we isolate the DNA, and we affix it to filter paper. And then we'll need a probe in order to find out which it is. And to do that, we'll have to sequence the enzyme itself, just at the beginning and the end. And because the code for which DNA is going to match up to the amino acid is degenerate, we're going to need to construct multiple DNA sequences. And we fluorescently tag these or radioactively label them. And then we're going to wash these over our filter paper, and it will hybridize to the colonies that contain the clones for the specific sequences in question. And then that will also tell us which of these sequences, which of the degenerate sequences is the correct one.
All right, and now I'm going to explain part D, how you...
James, talk to the class.
Oh, part D, how you produce an enzyme to block the effects of the flesh-eating protein. First, you have your sequence, like so, and that we have from part C, and we figure out, so we have which one it is, and we switch the... Because the promoter on the sense strand is switched to the anti-sense strand, or we do that in order to create an mRNA that will bind with that in the cell, the mRNA that's producing the virus and the transfer RNA, or the ribosomes and such, and we put that in a lambda virus, the anti-sense strand with a different promoter. And we put that in the virus, and then have the virus have a type of the arms will bind to the bacteria sites, and that'll go in and the
2 minutes,
and the protein and that enzyme will bind to the other enzyme and therefore neutralize it, so it won't produce the flesh eating. Yeah, the RNA will bind, so it won't produce the flesh eating enzyme, and that'll be the drug.
Okay, so I'm talking about the patent part, and basically I wrote that down so I would remember. Okay, so first the invention, the process itself, and which they all went through, the sequences associated with that process, and also the drug. And then utilities and claims. This can obviously be used to basically cure the flesh-eating disease, because...
of reasons already described. Novelty, nobody else has come up with this, using the viral vector also, and the idea of blocking by using a sequence to block the creation of this enzyme. Not obviousness, nothing like this has been done before. Nobody else has published it or talked about it. Best mode of practice, basically the process described earlier.
Just to clarify with the not obviousness part, it's also the idea that anyone, any Joe Blow couldn't know this sequence. Any Joe Blow wouldn't be able to do this process. And that's why we think it's novel. And that's why we think that it's not obvious.
Challenge. What group is it?
We won't have a mic then.
Challenge. Four minutes.
Okay,
what's your group?
Group one.
Turn your mic on.
Hello? Okay. For part D, is there any other activity that your drug can use, that can do to block the activity of the flesh-eating enzyme besides the mRNA blocking?
Another thing that you could do, it would be slightly more difficult in terms of actually being able to do it, but another thing you could do is once the enzyme is made, if you change the structure of the enzyme or like cleave the enzyme in some way, it loses its ability to function as it would. And so by changing the enzyme, you would also be able to stop it from working.
My question is also regarding part D of that. You said you would put the mRNA that would block into a lambda virus. So then how would you deliver that into a person per se? Like, would you stick a lambda virus in a person?
You
think
Brian.
That would be incredibly safe, or?
Well, the lambda virus, you're going to make it specialized so it attacks only the bacteria cells, because every cell is specific because of the protein sequence on the outside. So the lambda virus will recognize the bacteria, it'll infect the bacteria, and then neutralize the mRNA.
Okay, my question.
Have a follow-up question then? Go ahead. No, go ahead. Ask your question.
Okay. My question was regarding part C. I was just wondering how your answer would be different if the DNA were linear rather than circular.
Oh, how would my answer be different?
For part B, the answer would be different because if it's linear, you would need to have one extra piece so that they would overlap for the walking. Right.
Question?
Do you think that by patenting your process, would that benefit science or hurt science in the long run?
It's going to benefit science. First of all, there wouldn't be much motivation to do the research if nobody could make a profit, and you need people to invest in order for you to do this research. Also, it's only a temporary monopoly. After this is over, everybody can access that. And also, when you apply for a patent, you're putting all the information out there, how you do it, all the details. So it promotes public welfare and knowledge, and ultimately pushes forward science.
Question? Go ahead. Follow up.
Like in the question, it states that 90% of individuals who come into contact with it die if they're not treated with penicillin within 48 hours. So I guess the penicillin would work to kill the bacteria, but like my question would be, how would you stop the enzyme that's already secreted by the bacteria from continuing to kill the person? Because it seems you present a solution for the bacteria producing the enzyme, but not for the enzyme that's still present within your system that would eat your flesh.
You have 30 seconds.
Okay. Yeah, we know if we know the enzyme, we know the structure of the enzyme, so we know the shape of the enzyme. And so we could theoretically construct basically an enzyme that would sort of latch onto the specific receptor sites that it used, which would neutralize the effect of the enzyme itself.
The enzyme we produced was complementary to that one, so it would neutralize that one as well. The mRNA, that's what I meant. mRNA.
Any other questions from anyone in the class? TAs? What were the requirements for writing a patent and obtaining a patent? What are the five? Or?
Well, first you have to state the...
Just list them.
Oh, invention, utilities and claims, novelty, non-obviousness, and best mode of practice.
Good job. Erase the board. You know, I'm going in order here, so I better switch because it gets a little too boring to keep going in order, so we're going to do question number four. So what is the answer group? What is the challenge group? Challenge group? Okay. Now let's take a deep breath. Everyone, seriously, we're halfway through, doing a magnificent job, but we still have a long way to go. So those of you that have already gotten up, some of you haven't done your challenges yet, so please pay attention, but I can guarantee you that there will be surprises. I've just been very conservative up till now. Okay. Again, what is the answer group?
One.
And the challenge group, where are you?
Two.
Great. This deals with a crime case.
Okay.
So let's go.
So we're dealing with a high-profile murder case here, and the first question points out what are our requirements to obtain a blood sample from one of our suspects. Basically, what we have to do is present the case to the judge and... go to a judge in order to obtain a search warrant, and then once we get a search warrant, we could go to our suspect and obtain the blood sample from them. A constitutional right that needs to be addressed, and that's why this process exists, is the Fourth Amendment, which protects all of us against illegal searches and seizures. So that's that.
Okay, and then I'll be covering part of B. So first you isolate DNA from your hair samples, the three hair samples, from the blood from the suspect and the clothes of the murder victim. And then you use PCR to amplify all those DNA samples to find for the 13 VNTR regions. So it's like a type of a RFLP. And then you add the monomorphic loci probe to check for band shifting, because like you look at the you choose a region where it's apparent all of them, and then you see if it shifts, and it shifts by that much or whatever. So, and then Brian will do the rest.
Okay, so then when you have your amplified 13 regions, there are two ways that you can check to see if those regions match. One is by putting the DNA from each sample in a different gel, and then running those gels and seeing if the bands line up. And then, again, the monomorphic loci probe accounts for band shifting. And the other way would be to run them through a tube, a sort of catheter, and then a computer would check for spikes after you add fluorescent tags to each of the different regions and make sure that they line up and that your hair samples or one of them would match your suspect's DNA. And to go more over that is Easter.
You can't just tell the jury all this because they won't understand it. So you have to put it in a presentable way. So what you would probably do is you could show them an audio radiograph that shows like the hair from the crime scene and the suspect's gel and maybe like the policeman who collected it. And if the policeman, you test for 13 different loci I'm not going to draw them all up here, but if they all line up with the suspects and the police is totally different, then that sort of indicates that the suspect is probably the person who committed the crime. You can also show it in a graph, but this works fine.
And to calculate the probability of a match, you would try to figure out the probability of each allele in the general population, which you could do if you had a sample population, say like in CODIS or something. So if you had the proportion of a single gene that is expressed as that allele in the entire population, that's the probability that a person is going to have that specific allele. And then you multiply that by the probability that they'll have the other allele, and if you do it over 13 different loci, then you have, assuming that each one is relatively rare, an amazingly high like probability that the two match, somewhere in the millions or billions.
All right, I'm doing part E, and that talks about adding suspect DNA into DNA databases in California. So at the moment, you can't really do that, at least automatically. If you're convicted, your DNA automatically gets put into the DNA database in California at the moment. Suspects, like we said earlier, you have to have warrants, and you have to go through a lot of things because of the Fourth Amendment and other, you know, laws and rights to privacy. But Prop 69, which goes into effect in 2009, would allow you to, will actually allow California to take suspect DNA and enter it into databases that they want to. And if the suspect is found innocent, they can then request that DNA to be removed from the database, but it's on their own account, and they have to go through all the motions on their own, and they get no help from the state.
Challenge?
So in regards to part A, what sort of procedures would you have to take in order to ensure that there's no contamination when you're collecting DNA evidence, or just evidence in general?
When you're collecting DNA evidence, you have to be really careful to not contaminate it with the person that's collecting it with their DNA. You could use gloves, and you could use disposable. What's the word I'm looking for?
Go ahead.
You put each sample in a different bag. I think you use different sets of gloves. You use several different sets of tweezers. You don't. Yeah. Different swabs. Everything is disposable. I mean, it used to be that they would wash it, but that was found to be still lead to some contamination.
How much time?
Okay, so you guys mentioned 13 loci at least 6 times. What's the significance of 13? Why can't I just use 1 or 2 if I want to use this?
If you were to use 1 or 2 loci, you wouldn't be able to narrow down the probability that a person had that allele as well as much as you would with 13 loci. So by using the more loci you would use, the lesser probability that a person would randomly match that sample that you collected. So 13 is a good number because it puts us somewhere within the trillions that you would have that person randomly match.
So say that I'm getting my mic to work.
Say that I'm a skeptical juror, or not skeptical, but I'm just a little confused. Is this necessarily saying that the person committed the crime, or just that that's their hair? And if so, how would you know that they carry on the case?
Yeah, one of the problems with that is, A, that DNA doesn't necessarily establish causality. It can't make you guilty. It can only prove that you're innocent, because it can show that you definitely weren't like the person whose blood or whatever was at the crime scene. And the other part of that is, even, you know, if your DNA, if the suspect's DNA does match, let's say, like blood found on the victim, it still doesn't necessarily prove without a shadow of a doubt that the person committed the crime. It's just saying that there's only a 1 in 5 trillion possibility that it's, you know, but that's still a possibility.
2 minutes. Questions?
Yeah. Could you actually explain how the process of PCR works? Because it's kind of vague that you just say use PCR.
How PCR works is you find primers attaching to different sides. So here, I'll draw it.
You only have a minute, Brian. So do it conceptually.
You have primers that attach to either end of the region that you want amplified. They will amplify this direction, and this one will amplify this direction. Before that, you would denature the strand, so you'd have 2 strands. So then it would make a complementary strand, so then you have 2 strands here, and then 4, then 8. So you'd repeat the cycle X amount of times until you got enough DNA.
Question?
I just wanted to clarify on this. Like, for example, with this particular thing, the police would probably be excluded because none of his loci match up, but the suspect cannot be excluded because his lines match up. So it's not saying that he's absolutely it, but it looks like he probably is.
Question?
Yeah.
Last question.
Why are you allowed to use the statistics for a general population for the allele frequencies? Because
what happened was they went around different cities in the United States and sampled different people from different maybe ethnic backgrounds and other walks of life, and then they would see their DNA, and they found that if you were to test an excellent, like I think it was about 200 people, then you could determine with good certainty the amount that allele occurs within the population.
Is, and,
And you may want to consider specific subpopulations if that's relevant, like in the case of our case with the Amish population.
In your answer, you use the polymerase chain reaction to come up with these bands. But then the other part of your group answer said that you used autoradiography to detect these bands. What's wrong with that?
You actually don't need to use autoradiography. What happens is when you run it through a gel.
Explain that to some of your group members.
Okay, when you would use autoradiography to pick up radioactivity within each band, but what happens is when you use PCR, it amplifies only certain regions, so then that DNA will actually show up if you add dye just on your gel and if you luminesce it from the back.
So you don't need any autoradiography.
You don't need autoradiography.
Is that correct? And when you were calculating these probabilities, I heard something about calculating allelic frequencies. Are you sure that you're calculating allelic frequencies or some other kind of frequency? What's the name for it?
Genotypic frequencies.
Thank you. Good job. Okay, let's go to question number 7. Hold it. What's the answer group?
Five.
Answer group is 5. Challenge group?
3.
Challenge group 3. Okay, hold it. Seriously. Najla? Karina, thank you. Timer? You have 8 minutes to talk about something that we spent a lot of time in class discussing, the glowfish. Where's your microphone? And be succinct. You only have 8 minutes.
Okay, well then, conceptually, my goal right now is to isolate the actual cDNA clone of that allows this jellyfish to become fluorescent. And the way you would first do that, given the population of the jellyfish, you would isolate the DNA from the cells of the jellyfish. Then you would create a cDNA library. You could do this in a variety of ways, using plasmids or vectors and E. coli. Once you had yourself a library, you have a purified fluorescent protein, and you would reverse engineer using the universal genetic code a different number of possibilities of DNA sequences that would code for this gene. And there would be several different possibilities because of the degenerate nature of the universal genetic code. Once you did this, you would fluoresce each different possibility, different color, run it across your library, and the one that attaches onto it, that color, whatever it corresponds to, the X number of different nucleotide sequences would be your gene or your clone.
Okay, part B, basically what you want to get is the...
Speak into your microphone.
The zebrafish exo, and what you want to do is you're going to use recombinant DNA.
What's the goal here?
You want to make the pet zebrafish glow like the other fish.
Mm-hmm.
So since you have identified the gene from the genome or the library you created, what you're going to do is get the exo and you're going to insert the gene into its DNA by using restriction enzymes, polymerase and ligase to obviously paste them back together, the phosphodiester bonds and the hydrogen bonds. And once you insert it back and it starts dividing, you also want to insert a promoter, of course, so it will be expressed. And once it starts dividing, it will be able to glow in every cell when it's fertilized.
Okay, I'm doing part C. And Rodina actually touched upon this, but DNA being the genetic material, there are a few necessary characteristics of DNA. And this shows really explicitly is the universality of DNA, and that's the DNA is made up of ATGC, and you can transfer a gene from one species that normally can't, has a breeding barrier with the other species, so you can take the gene from the jellyfish and put it into a normal fish. Additionally, the change in the genotype is making a change in the phenotype, which is not always, it doesn't always occur, but in this case you can see that a change in the genetic code is causing a change in the fish just by its appearance, and that means that it has taken it up and it is replicating it in itself.
So I'm going to talk about the properties that a molecule has to have if it's the genetic material, because we've shown that DNA is the genetic material because we just took the DNA and inserted it into a regular fish, and it the property showed up in the regular fish. And for a molecule to be the genetic material, it has to be in all of the cells of an organism. It has to be able to replicate so it can go into other cells and so that it can be hereditarily passed on. And it has to have some type of code so that the proteins can be produced that differentiates different proteins to be produced.
Okay, I'm going to explain the scientific method and how this experiment satisfies the process. So first you would make your observations, which in this case you observe that the jellyfish has the capability of glowing, and your hypothesis is that the DNA is what causes, what gives the jellyfish the ability to glow. It's a green fluorescence DNA. So then you would design an experiment to prove that it is the DNA that is causing the fluorescence. So your experiment, you're isolating the DNA from the jellyfish and inserting only the DNA into the zebrafish. So you're not in, the DNA is the only thing included, not the nucleus or anything, so there's no possibility that like proteins would be the genetic material. So then you conduct your experiment and you collect and analyze the data, and in this case the data shows that it is, since the fluorescence protein is expressed in the zebrafish, the DNA is the genetic material and causes the zebrafish to glow. So you make your conclusions based on your analysis of the data, which is that DNA is the genetic material. And then you have to repeat the experiment, and also outside experiments must be conducted to show that the data is valid and wasn't like a result of a flaw.
Two more minutes.
Okay, quickly, I'm going to discuss the characteristics of law on the California state level and federal that would allow the California state legislature to make a law that would ban the sale of these transgenic fish. And particularly here, we're looking at commerce because it involves the sale. And under the federal state or the federal constitution, Article 1 says that the Congress regulate intrastate commerce, which is between states or among states. And so by the 10th Amendment, which says that powers not granted to the federal government specifically are reserved to either the people or the states. And so it is within the power of the California state legislature, as long as these fish are not produced outside of the state or not shipped outside of the state, so long as it's completely like intrastate. Then the California state legislature has the power to regulate the sale, at least, of this transgenic fish. And also the federal constitution, the national constitution, says that it is within the power of government to regulate things that may, you know, provide for the common defense or promote the general welfare. So if there was something about this transgenic animal or something like it that may pose some sort of a threat to society at large, then it would be one of their goals, or it would be a legitimate use of government power to prevent it.
Challenge questions?
Okay, my question relates to part A. What is a codon, and
related to that, why are there several different strands of cDNA that you must use to find the gene for the fluorescent protein?
Well, the universal genetic code works in nucleotide sequences of three, and so three nucleotides that are in the genetic code equal one codon, and in turn, these codons code for amino acids, which in turn compose proteins. However, there is when I said degeneracy, I meant that there is more than one three nucleotide sequence that codes for a given amino acid, and therefore, a protein, when you're going backwards, there's a possibility that there's two different sets of three nucleotides that code for the same amino acid, so you have to allow for that error to be occurring, if that answers your question.
Question?
Also,
2 minutes.
Also for part A, what is the difference between a genomic library and a cDNA library, and why did you choose to use the cDNA library in this case?
A genomic library contains all of the genes in a genome, including genes that don't like code for a protein or anything. They have really no functional use in the cell. They're kind of junk DNA. So the genomic library would contain everything. And the cDNA library, on the other hand, is synthesized using mRNA that's found in the cells. You use the reverse transcriptase in order to synthesize essentially just the DNA that's of use in a particular cell. And so we have chosen to use the cDNA because we can identify the cells where this like protein is produced, and we can like kind of narrow the possibilities down to just what's within the cell.
Questions?
I wanted to know, you took a protein, DNA sequence from a jellyfish and put it into another fish. What would you have to do to make sure it's expressed because it's from a different species?
I believe you have to insert the promoter that would the promoter would basically tell it to be expressed.
And it would have to be specifically a promoter not from the jellyfish but from the zebrafish. Side note.
Question?
Okay, my question is about part F. I'm not going to hold you over the coals on this one, but I'm wondering if there's any reason that a reasonable person would think that this is going to pose a danger to the people of California, having a glowing zebrafish.
Maybe they'd worry it would get out into the wild and compete with other fishes, and change, maybe affect their environment if there were a glowfish in, say, like dark waters or something, and then there were fish that couldn't survive in that kind of environment.
1 minute.
My question's for B again. How could you get the glow to appear in just the gills or just the tail of the fish?
To have it expressed in only a specific section, you'd use a promoter specific to the gills or whatever. So it would only be expressed in cells in that area.
For part B, you mentioned using restriction enzymes and stuff. Isn't there an easier way to get the gene into the zebrafish?
Well, you could. I know there's been done where you directly just inject the DNA, but you also want to look at the efficiency of the methods you're using.
Question asked to isolate a cDNA clone. But your group started with isolating DNA. Mike? Group started with isolating DNA. I'm confused as how you get a cDNA clone starting with DNA.
I think we were starting with a protein. And then
so now you're going to make cDNA starting with a protein?
No, we're going to get the different sequences.
Get together on this, because this is very conceptual with respect to your answer. It asks for making a cDNA clone, and now you've started with DNA, and now we're starting with protein. What's your answer? What's your starting material going to be? turn your microphone off. What's the starting material going to be for isolating, for making a cDNA library and isolating a cDNA clone?
mRNA.
Pardon?
mRNA.
Well, but you said originally DNA. You're going to take that back and say you're going to start with RNA now?
Well, from, because you're starting...
You might watch not putting your foot in your mouth here. We're going to start with RNA or DNA?
With RNA.
Where are you going to get this RNA from this jellyfish?
Reverse engineering.
From the whole jellyfish as a whole? Or
no, you have the purified green fluorescence protein. So...
Where are you going to get the RNA to start with your cDNA library? Go ahead, Josh.
Well, I guess you would find where this particular protein is being produced in the jellyfish, and then by...
What if it was produced everywhere?
Then you could use mRNA from any part of the jellyfish.
Or the whole jellyfish.
Or the whole jellyfish.
So I'm still confused at how you make this cDNA clone. You haven't told me anything about... how you make this cDNA clone. I heard about proteins, I heard about DNA. How do you make this cDNA clone?
You use reverse transcriptase.
Okay, tell the class.
You use reverse transcriptase, which will reverse, you have the RNAs, and it will create a copy, it will copy back to make a cDNA.
Okay. And so now we're done. We have reverse transcriptase, and we have Shauna.
Yeah, I'll take it. So you have the mRNA to start with, and you use that as your, you can call it a template if you want. And mm-hmm. So if you use reverse transcriptase, it will synthesize a complementary strand. And using an alkali solution, you can eliminate the RNA and synthesize using DNA polymerase another complement or like a strand that's complementary to the strand of cDNA that you've created. And you can cut off the loop using an S1 nuclease. And that would be the segment. And then you can insert it into a plasmid to keep it as a library and amplify it. But that would be the way you make your segment.
So the final question I have for you is that your group said that you're inserting the jellyfish green fluorescent gene into the zebrafish. Are you using the gene or are you using the cDNA? Because I kept hearing gene.
Sorry, the cDNA.
So what do you have to do to the cDNA in order to get it active in the zebrafish?
You would have to put a promoter that would like help it be expressed for the cDNA.
Excellent. You just rescued yourselves. Good job. Okay, let's go to question number... Where in the heck are we? Losing my concentration here. Let's go to question number 5. Who's the answer group? Group 4? Challenge group? Okay, now, we have 2 more questions to go. So let's take a couple deep breaths and... Brian, Jason,
I'm not talking first.
So we have a couple more questions to go, and then there might be some surprises. So let's take a couple deep breaths. Guys, ready? So give these last groups the same attention and thoughtfulness that they... No, don't move my computer. Please don't move my computer. I need it open. Thank you.
How long have I got you, dude?
Thank you, Tomo. Sorry for that little interlude. I have to put it on sleep again. So let's give these guys and gals the same focus and concentration and attention as we've done. It's been a superb job so far. Flawless.
Okay, we're going to start off with part A here.
Go ahead.
It asks for the mode of inheritance of the metabolic disorder. rather than draw this whole thing up there, you can look at your graph. You can see that neither the parents on the right in the first generation.
Why don't you put some of the squares up here so that we can, the key things here, Matt.
You'll notice that neither the parents express the disease, the mutation. So, and then you take a look at their offspring, and you see that two of them do express it. So that means that though they don't express the gene, they must carry the mutant gene. So then we know it's recessive. And then we know whether or not they're homozygous or heterozygous because in order for any of their offspring to have the phenotypically express the trait, it must be homozygous recessive. So that means each one of the parents must contribute a recessive gene, which means each parent is heterozygous. Is heterozygous, so they have big A, little a, and then the other parent also has a big A, little a. So that way it allows for the expression of both the recessive mutant gene and the dominant normal gene.
What's the next part?
For part B, I'm going to talk about how an error in DNA could lead to something wrong in a protein. So DNA is translated into mRNA, which is then translated into, wait, no, DNA is transcribed into mRNA, which is then translated to protein. From here to protein, it's with the help of tRNAs, which are going to be complementary to our mRNA, and they're going to have anticodons on them. And then when the anticodons string together, we have our protein. So the problem here is like cause and effect. If we had something wrong here, if it wasn't covered by degeneracy, then the problem would manifest itself again in the protein. And then we would get the protein with the wrong amino acids, the wrong shape, and then with the wrong shape, the protein is not going to work.
Okay, so part C involves the ASO DNA testing procedure. ASO stands for allele-specific oligonucleotide. And basically, you're using a short nucleotide sequence. That's what's good about this. You only have to use a short one. And it basically relies on the principle that if you have a single nucleotide displacement, there will be less stable at a given temperature. So you, in that way, you're able to tell right away which one is present because you put it at the certain temperature, and the one that remains stable would be the normal one, and then the one that does remain stable is the single placement and is the mutant.
So the main point of this question is they want to know how we're going to identify this gene causing this rare metabolic disorder. And my group members already touched on it a little bit, but the main concept here is this thing called collinearity, and that is like, it's pretty much saying that between proteins and DNA, although there's a lot of steps that go between them, they're like essentially the same in terms of what, like you could derive a DNA sequence from a protein in the same way that you could derive a protein from a DNA sequence. So on that note, what we can do is going to be explained by my other group member.
Okay, so we're assuming that we have a small amount of the enzyme. So first we would like analyze the enzyme and find out a small sequence of amino acids in it. And then using the genetic code, we can work backwards to make probes that would code for that sequence. Sorry. And then using our human genomic library, we would search for that sequence, that probe that we made. And then we would also have to find out where the enzyme was made so we could find mRNA and make a cDNA so we could know when to stop, and we would like walk along until we found the end of our gene, and that's how we would sequence our gene.
Okay, so part E, you find out that the disorder can be cured 100% of the time, and it's just asking how you could legally make it mandatory, allow the state to require mandatory screening.
Some people would argue against that by saying that the Fourth Amendment prohibits illegal search and seizure. The blood needed to do the test would be an illegal seizure. But there are several things that override that. It's kind of the idea in Article 1, Section 8, it gives Congress or the government the right to promote the general welfare. So by doing this testing, if it could be cured all the time and there's no risk of doing the testing, then you would be obviously protecting the newborns against getting the disease, which is kind of the idea of parens patrias. It gives the state the right to kind of act as a guardian for those who can't defend themselves. And then also, the 10th Amendment also applies those powers that aren't given to the federal government. It applies it to the state, so that would allow the state to be able to do this. And in some states, they do have like an option. If it's against your religious beliefs, then you can opt out of it, and that doesn't violate your First Amendment freedom of religion.
Challenge? What's the challenge group?
Six, right. So my first question is a general question, and you touched on it a little bit, but I was wondering if you could talk a little more about why you would use ASO analysis versus RFLP analysis. Why not use it in this case? Why not use it in general?
Well, as I said, the benefit of ASO is you can detect a single nucleotide displacement on a small nucleotide strand, whereas in the other strategy you need a longer strand, and it's difficult to isolate the single nucleotide issue.
Question is, why use it in this specific case, and why use it in general?
Also,
can you answer that question?
Well, suppose in this specific case that the mutation that caused the disease didn't...
Look at the question before you answer it. Why use it in this specific case, and why use it in general?
Because in this case, it helps you identify the gene knowing how it was inherited. So you know that it relates to the being heterozygous and homozygous and the different different alleles.
Next question.
I just have a brief question. You had mentioned codons. I distinctly remember reading about anticodons. I was wondering if conceptually you could describe the difference between the two and what their purpose is.
So anticodons are the ones on the tRNA, and then codons are the ones on mRNA. And then tRNAs are the one that eventually string together. Anticodons are the ones that in the end string together to form the protein that you want to look for.
Actually, it's a follow-up question. So are you saying that the tRNA is the one that that's actually stringing together, or what's actually happening in the process of creating the protein?
In the actual process, the anticodons are on the tRNA, and the tRNA connects to the amino acid that codon codes for. And so you have your codon, and then your tRNA comes and matches with the anticodon, and with the ribosome's help, it strings the amino
acids together. Next question. 2 minutes.
In the question, you're advising against them having kids because of their close genetic relationship. So scientifically, why is that the case?
For part of the reason is because for some diseases, it's like, especially here, it's recessive, that if close relatives get married, and then it increases the chance of the recessive allele getting together. And then if you had two recessive, then you would get the disease.
And like, if you're, everyone has like some recessive alleles that, you know, could cause mutations. But when you're marrying some random person, the chances of you guys having the same recessive alleles is much lower than if you're marrying someone you're closely related to.
Sort of just, it exaggerates, inbreeding exaggerated traits, you know, the same way, like, you know, jaws get bigger and bigger, and, like, one of the royal families wasn't that until they, like, couldn't chew. So, like, it's true. And then, so this is the same thing. The trait of the mutation is going to increase the likelihood, all that stuff.
I have a question about, for part B. It says that
the genetic disease is due to metabolic defect or inborn error metabolism, which is basically like the genetic or biochemical basis for the disease. What are the different types of these biochemical bases for the disease that exist?
One would be the, as we described, the single nucleotide displacement. I don't know if anyone else would like to.
Yeah, there can be insertions, deletions, inversions, duplications. All these things are going to have an effect on the genetic code, and therefore, due to the collinearity of it, are going to affect the protein.
One last question. Is it your turn?
You mentioned in the beginning of your answer why one would use the ASO technique, but I still haven't really heard in this particular circumstances the advantages of using the ASO technique. You explained something about single nucleotides, which I understand, but you really haven't said anything about, in this specific example, which would cause one to use this particular methodology.
I believe because of the recessive nature of the...
Could use a blot to do the same thing.
Well, I mean, I think you could. I think the idea is this
so what's,
efficient
what's the
shows
reason
you right
for,
here.
So what's the specific reason for using the ASO technique in this particular situation?
Well, in this particular situation, perhaps the there isn't a fragment restriction enzyme site that's deleted or inserted by this mutation.
What's the specific advantage of using the ASO technique in this specific example?
Is it because they're testing embryos and so you don't need very much DNA?
You tell me.
It's because they're using embryos.
What's the part of the ASO procedure that you've left out? You described like one strand and a little, you know, mismatch, but you left out the whole technique. So how does the ASO technique work?
Well, what you do is you have your sample of DNA. You have probes.
So conceptually, what conceptually is done during this thing called the ASO? Just conceptually.
Conceptually, the temperature is raised to denature.
Still leaving out a very important step. Yes, I understand that we have little short probes, and we have hybridization reactions, and we distinguish between a mutant probe and a wild-type probe on the basis of temperature. But that's only a tiny fraction of what this procedure is all about. So what are you missing that's absolutely the critical reason for using this procedure with the example in Figure 2? Because there are a lot of other procedures you could have used, like, you know, DNA blots and whole bunch of other things. How come using this particular procedure? How much time do we have, Mike?
We're out.
Time me. What's the answer?
It's because for using this procedure, we can tell precisely whether it was homo.
Well, I know we know all of that, but what part of the procedure are you missing that's so essential to using it? The whole raison d'etre for using this procedure. You're leaving out one very important step. How do you start this procedure? Maybe I should phrase that question that way. Nick Christensen. What is the ASO procedure? So what's the step that's being left out here that's critical? You guys are going to go like this when you... I know you know it.
You would allow the probes to hybridize to
even
the...
before all of that. Nejla.
it's right. Can you hear me?
Turn the mic on.
Taking it to the 8-cell stage, taking the one cell from the 8-cell embryo or blastocyst. It's right in front of you guys. It's on the picture.
Yeah, but what is the reason for using the ASO procedure? Figure 2, we chose to analyze the genotypes of those individuals, not so by doing DNA blots, not by using...
This is before you implant these embryos for them to have them.
But
so
what part of the procedure allows you to do this? Samer, do you want to take a step? What's the first part of the ASO procedure?
Well, it's put on a Petri dish agar plate, right? So you can test a bunch of them at the same time.
What's the first step in the ASO procedure?
You harvest the eggs from the girl.
Right.
So you can tell from the beginning.
Okay, just time out. Everything that you're saying is absolutely correct. Harvest the eggs, get the cells, hybridize, mismatching, higher temperature, low temperature. But there's one major conceptual thing that's being missed here that allows the whole procedure to work. Ms. Hale?
Would you need to identify where the single point mutation is so that you can use that as a probe?
One, but how do you, in this circumstance, how come the ASO procedure was started? Karina, do you want to try?
It takes like 5 minutes to do.
But,
so it's faster, and you're testing
why,
for...
But why, conceptually, Radina? I want you to think about the procedure before you answer now. I'm asking a technical question.
ASOs only work with really, really short sequences.
That's all correct. Everything you've said is correct, but you're leaving out the most important...
TCR.
Thank you. You have to use the polymerase chain reaction to amplify the gene region in the single cell that you assay from the 8-celled embryo. Good job. Thank you. So you could never do this using a DNA blot or a Southern blot. Okay, so we have one question left. Wait, I haven't called it yet. So let's just gather our concentration, because there'll be a couple surprises in a few minutes. Let's go to question number one. Maybe we'll do it over again. Question number 6. Okay, hold it. Last question. Last question of the entire class. So we have group number what as the answer?
Group 3.
And challenge? Great. And some honorary members.
Okay, naturally we're beginning with part A. And the goal here is to create 10 genetically engineered goat clones that will produce super levels of a human antigen in their milk. And so to begin, you need to identify a promoter that is specific for the goat mammary glands so that this will be promoted in their milk. And then you need to attach that to cDNA, which you will, for the antiviral antigen A, which you create from the messenger RNA, which you're provided with using reverse transcriptase. Mm-hmm. And then after that.
Okay, now that you have the promoter attached to the cDNA for the gene, you need to fertilize a goat egg and insert the gene into the male pronucleus. Then there's a
chance that the DNA will be incorporated into the chromosomes of that goat. So you then implant that cell or that embryo into the womb of a goat, and when it's born, you can use an antibody test of its milk to find if the protein is expressed.
Very good.
And then when you have that one goat, because you know that it is producing this protein in its milk, you will repeat the cloning process with that goat because you already know that it's it has the DNA that's working to produce this protein that you want.
Yeah, that process entails taking 10 goat egg cells and then 10 somatic cells from your goat that expresses the protein, enucleating the egg cells and ejecting the somatic cells into the nucleated eggs, and then electroshocking them to start cell division and then implanting them.
Very good.
And then you can do some kind of RFLP analysis to make sure that they're clones at the end.
And we'll talk about in part
G. Yeah, but for part B, how would you protect its genetically engineered antiviral antigen A from use by its competitors and give it protected name recognition? To protect its name, you would obviously, or actually to protect the actual product itself, you would patent it, and you're allowed to do that due to the Supreme Court ruling, Chakrabarty versus Diamond, where it was ruled that anything manipulated by the hands of man under the sun is able to be patented, whether it be genes or, you know, anything, even inventions. And it's also a constitutional right, given that you're able to patent something and to be allowed to hold a temporary monopoly on it to prevent any other person or company to use that process for commercial use without your written consent or permission, or like without receiving royalties or any other compensation like that. And oh yeah, the copyright. Yeah. So after you after we produce the clones that make that milk, you'd actually want to copyright. Well, I mean, you'd have a name for the milk. You'd have the patent for it, and you'd copyright like the name for the milk, like I don't know, like goat juice or something like that, or vitamin G. That'd be good. I don't know why that'd be good, but you'd have something like that, and you could copyright that name so that like and goat gen in general, so that no other company could like make a product or use your name wrongfully to like advertise their own things or like misadvertise your company's doings or something like that.
Okay, now we're going to address part C, trying to unambiguously determine that the 10 sheep we produced are clones. We have four specific VNTR, which is variable
variable number
tandem repeats. So we're gonna amplify we're gonna create a probe using these tandem repeats, and we're gonna take the DNA from all 10 sheep and from the original, and so we're gonna, and then we also have these VNTRs, create a probe using that, amplify the sections, VNTR segments, using PCR.
And then after you've amplified, I want to add something to what you said. We're going to use our four goat-specific VNTR clones as primers for PCR so that they will recognize the sequence in our regular goat DNA from the 10 sheep that we cloned. So after we do PCR and we've amplified the DNA from all the different 10 clones, we're going to run it on a gel. And Patricia will talk about in part D, like the results of the gel. But you can use the gel, you can check it out, and if they all line up, then you can calculate probability using
your... 2 minutes.
You can calculate probability using your Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium equation, or you can just look at the gel and say they all line up, and therefore they're clones.
Well, basically, just like Heather said, we're using our VNTRs as probes, and since for this one, Molly and clone one, for example, they all match up. That means that they're perfect. They're a perfect match. We have, they're genetically identical, and VNTRs for Molly, she has four. Clone one has four as well, and that's unique, I guess you can say, because, well, yeah, they are the same link. Polly might have a different number of variable number tandem repeats, and that...
So Polly doesn't match.
Right, Polly doesn't match because she doesn't have the same number of repeats.
And we're not going to use the Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium, because that's for genotypic frequencies in a population. That's not really...
Challenge?
Applicable.
I'm curious if my microphone's on.
Question, Jordan, specific.
I've heard a lot of talk about this cDNA stuff. I'm curious, why is it, like, what's the advantage of using cDNA over DNA?
cDNA doesn't include the introns. So that means that it's only the coding region.
So what exactly is an intron, or do things called exons exist?
An intron is just a series of nucleotides that may exist within a gene that do not necessarily get turned into messenger RNA when the cell is directing for a protein to be made. So it does not contribute to the gene, and that's the advantage of using cDNA, because it is the uninterrupted gene sequence that codes directly for the protein.
Next question.
What are some of the other ways to synthesize human proteins for use in medicine, and
Specific, Matt.
Why would you choose this method? What are the benefits
To... Another method you could use is bacteria to produce your protein. But for more complex proteins that require post-translational modifications, you'd want to use a eukaryote and also maybe a mammal, because it would have the cellular machinery to carry out those modifications.
I think a reason that the goat cheese is or goat milk is used is because, like he was saying, you'd have to, to get vaccinated, you have to get injections and needles, and you'd have professional healthcare helping you do that. Whereas with goat cheese or goat milk, it could be transported or refrigerated, and you could distribute it more easily and with less professional healthcare needed and expenses.
Then what?
It's also a renewable source of the protein, because you don't need to kill the animal for it. It will just produce milk as long as it's lactate.
Put your hands together for HC70A.
You guys will never, ever, ever, ever have another class like this. Mike, can I get some help from you?
You're not going to throw cake at me again, are you? Because I'm going to stand a little bit.
Oh, yeah, I put it in your face last year. I think that you... I must say, we're only going to spend a couple minutes here, and I'm going to say some brief things, and then we're going to show our projects. We'll show your project, but we also have one for you that you don't know about. And, you know, turnabout is fair play. And then I'll have some final remarks. So I only want to say that this is a tradition, like a lot of traditions. You know, I don't really want to take this out of here because you're going to see it outside. But this is a tradition like a lot of traditions that I have. And in order to make a class like this, there's a tremendous amount that goes on in the background, that it's an enormous production. And many, 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 many people have been involved in this production, some of whom aren't here now. But I think it's important for us to thank our wonderful audiovisual people who have... I'm not going to spend much time on this, but we went through at least three rehearsals before this class started with all this equipment and the sound and the room and the filming and everything. And if they can deal with me, they can do anything because I expect perfection. So Jack and all of your crew, thank you very, very, very much for a job which is really well done. The second thing is that this class could never be done without two really superb teaching assistants, Gloria and Mike, who worked their really, really tails off trying to give you the best discussions that they possibly could give you, but also to show you that discussion sections can be a little bit different than the ordinary kind of run-of-the-mill discussion section. And since they're your contemporaries, I think they've done an extra special job of pulling things together. And so thank you, Mike, and thank you, Gloria, but I already thanked you guys earlier. And then we have to thank Jessica, who really coordinated this entire class and was really behind the scenes and doing everything. And as Jessica will tell you, we really started organizing this class way back when in September. I mean, it really took the entire fall quarter to put all of this together, to put this class on for you. And it took a tremendous amount of effort. And Jessica did, as always, a fabulous job. And so let's thank her tremendously. And then there was a few people who aren't here. And those are the work-study students that work for us in the laboratory, and they were there, you know, every morning at 8 o'clock Xeroxing all of your handouts and helping me and compiling all of these things and Xeroxing Mike and Gloria's handouts and all the stuff that you've gotten. So they were important. And then, of course, Tomo, you know, and has come in and who's not here, but I wish he was, or maybe he's outside or something, and Brandon, all of these people really working behind the scenes, I mean, in making this production. So let's give them a big hand. And again, these are not going to be my final comments that I have for you, because I do have some, but the most important people to thank for all of this class are all of you. And I mean that, because you endured 10 weeks of a totally radical way of teaching. And your performance today, in terms of the science that you went through, was absolutely magnificent. Not only in the concepts that you were getting across, but in your team effort, your performance, it couldn't have been any better. I mean, it was like A plus plus. And I just think that when one teaches a class like this, I, as the professor, have to thank all of you, because this is what it's all about, and without you, there couldn't be a class. And so, as a tradition in my classes going back now 20 years, I always present my class with a cake. And this is the cake, which is very appropriate for this class, made by Paris Pastry. We have the same artist at Paris Pastry for 20 years, and this person's really an artist. They've done all kinds of stuff for me, but it says, I survived HC70A with Bob Goldberg in the winter of 2006, and there it is, vector, cleave, ligate, anneal, and transform, and there's your recombinant plasmid, which I think is very appropriate for this particular class. Now, what I'd like to do is Jessica is going to, with Mike's help and Gloria's help, take this outside, and someone will be out there protecting it because we've had some stragglers that have been eating all of our food. And they're going to be out there cutting it and getting it ready for you. But let me just, before we do that, say what's going to happen now. We're going to show your class project. We're going to show our class project, which is really Jessica's class project, which she's been working very, very hard on. And then I'm going to say a few things to you guys. And then there's some paperwork that you have to fill out. And then we're going to have a reception outside where we're going to have cake and there's some tea and coffee and stuff like that. So why don't you take this away? And the projector's on, Jack? Okay. Let me move the screen down, and I'm assuming that we have some kind of DVD that'll play, hopefully, on my computer. If not, maybe it'll play on this system. But let me take the screen down. Who's got the class project? How long has it been? Oh, it should work. Hopefully, is there a sign outside saying don't come in or something? This other class? Pardon? Where's your DVD? Okay, great. So hopefully this is going to work. If not, we'll use the system. Do you have a script?
I gave it to Gloria.
Can I have it? Thank you. Is this a DVD or a CD? Let's pray. Do you have a copy? In case my computer eats it. Is that right so far? Are we? If I can get to it. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Is it working? Is there music? Okay. Is there sound?
And as you will see, unfortunately, our hypothesis is pretty much correct.
Roll tape.
Wow, that was great. How you doing, man?
Good, I'm good.
What's your name?
Otavio.
Otavio, how are you doing? I'm Jordan. If you don't mind, I'm just going to ask you a quick question.
All right.
I'm curious, do you think that you have eaten any genes today?
Genes of animals?
Yeah, genes of animals, not genes like clothes you're wearing.
No.
No, you don't
not
think
today,
so?
Not today.
Not today. Okay. Well, have you had anything to eat today?
I had eggs.
Okay. Thank you. Well, that was a good answer. Thanks a lot.
Hi, Daisy Robinson here at room 839 of Dykstra. I'm here with Alex, and we're here to ask Alex a question today.
Great.
Alex, do you know what the four bases of DNA are?
I don't.
Any chance of a guess?
Cheese, blood, milk, and cookies.
Good try.
Hi, this is Hannah. We're in Dykstra still. What's your name?
Simon.
Okay, well, Simon, I have a question for you.
Alright.
Do you know what genetic engineering is?
Yes, I do.
Can you give me a definition?
It is the modification of genes, DNA of various plants and maybe even animals for various methods or reasons.
Okay, so can you genetically engineer a human?
Theoretically, yeah. It's a bit harder to do practically.
Has a human ever been genetically engineered?
Not to my knowledge.
Thank you.
All right, so this is Sky. We're still in Jordan's room. Mario, and we're just going to ask a few questions. Mario, do you eat organic food?
I have.
You have?
Not regularly, though.
Okay, and do you think organic food is better than, you know, other food that
not particularly,
there's not any difference? Do you think if you put a fish gene in a tomato, that the tomato would taste fishy?
Probably not, no.
Probably not. All right, thank you.
Okay, can you state your name, please?
Jean-Marc Lyotard.
Okay, the first question we're going to ask you, Jean-Marc, is what does DNA stand for?
Desoxyribonucleic acid, something like that. I went to a French school. Like that?
Very good.
Hi, I'm Brian, and I'm here with
Kevin.
And Kevin, we just have a couple questions for you. What is DNA?
Deoxyribonucleic acid.
Okay, do you have any idea what DNA does?
It determines, like, your characteristics of, like, the proteins.
Okay. What are good and bad genes? Give me an example of a good gene.
Tall.
What's a bad gene?
Fat. Hi, I'm Nicholas Christian. I'm here with...
Brandon Dietz.
Great. Okay, Brandon.
Yes.
Tell me, what does DNA stand for? Your thoughts?
My thoughts would be it stands for deoxyribonucleic acid.
Very good.
Hi, I'm Matt Anderson, and I'm here with
Robin Walter.
And are you happy?
Oh, I'm ecstatic.
Good. Is this the happiest you've ever been?
Oh, it is.
Good. We're going to start off with a few questions here.
I love this stuff. I'm sorry.
The first one will be, how many genes do you think you've eaten today?
Probably about
47. 47 genes. That's a reasonable guess, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Second question we got for you. These are kind of tricky. So, second question. Oh, which has more genes? Corn or humans?
So you think I'm going to say humans, so I'm going to say corn.
Good answer.
When?
Hi, I'm Samantha DeVita, and I'm here with
Netta.
Okay. What do you think DNA stands for?
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Want to guess?
I don't have a guess. I really don't know.
Okay. What's the difference between therapeutic and reproductive cloning?
I don't know. I science is my worst subject, so I have no idea.
Thank you.
Excuse me. Can we ask you a few questions?
Sure.
Great. All right. This is on the go. Ready?
Are you walking? Or?
No, we're ready to go.
Oh, okay. Okay. I'm Easter Call, and this is
Emily Waldron.
I'm just going to ask you a few questions. Okay. What does DNA stand for?
DNA?
No pressure.
Something, oh, shoot, I don't know. I'm taking bio in like 3 years. It's like, yeah, no. It's like, does it end up something to do with like nucleus? Yeah, that's the only one I remember. Close.
Okay, do you think that bacteria's DNA and human's DNA can be combined?
I don't know. Yes? I'm just saying maybe.
All right, hi, this is Betty, and I'm here to ask you questions about genetics. So my first question would be, what is gene therapy, do you think?
this is totally a guess because I'm a North Campus major, so I really don't know much about genes, but I would think that gene therapy is a type of counseling to inform people about
genes. All right, that's a good answer. And then, how many genes do you think you have?
One.
Like hundreds or thousands?
Well, these type of genes, I only have like 10 pairs, maybe. But genetic genes, probably a million.
What's the difference
between the two genes?
They're spelled differently.
Great.
Hi, we're here at Whole Foods, and we're going to ask people around to see why exactly they're shopping at Whole Foods, spending all that extra money for essentially the same products they could get anywhere else. And we're going to find out exactly what they know about genes, genetic engineering, and the food that they're eating.
Hi, Karina.
We just wanted to ask a few questions about genetic engineering since we're doing a class project. How do you feel about genetically engineered foods? I'd rather not have organic. If you had a choice whether to purchase genetically engineered or organic. And why is that?
Just because it's more natural and not enhanced. I don't care for things added.
Do you think they're not natural? Do you think that there should be laws to label genetically engineered organisms in order to show consumers that they have been genetically engineered and to give them a choice of whether to purchase them or organic foods?
Yes. I know I don't have a number, but no one really.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, hi, we're here today asking customers at Whole Foods what they think about genetically modified organisms. How do you feel about purchasing genetically engineered food? Would you do it or would you prefer to be organic?
I should prefer organic, but if I'm hungry, I probably wouldn't care.
But if you had a choice, would you choose the organic over the genetically modified?
Yes.
Yes. And why is that?
I'd like to live as long as possible. I assume getting organic will help.
And would you also prefer that the government passes laws to require labeling of genetically modified foods in grocery stores?
That'd be nice, but I don't really put that much credit on our government, so I'd rather be in charge of what I eat than them.
Cool, thank you very much.
First off, what is your general perception of genetic engineering and genetically modified organisms? How do you feel about that in general?
Some things I think are okay, like seedless watermelon, if that counts, is that genetic engineering? Well, things like that I like, but things that get too genetically modified, I don't really like eating stuff like that, because, I don't know, things might be a little unhealthy.
Would you say that the media, such as like various movies like Gattaca, would you say that's had any effect on your perception of genetic engineering?
Actually, no. To me, no. No, it doesn't make a difference. I have my own views.
Okay, well, thank you.
Can you define a gene for us?
A gene? It's something that carries your characteristics or, I don't know, like a formal definition.
Have you eaten any genes today?
Have I eaten any genes?
Yes.
I don't think so.
UC knowledge about genetic engineering on the UCLA campus is at best disappointing.
In spite of Bob Goldberg's class, UCLA remains ignorant about the absolute truth of genetic engineering.
We'd like to thank
Mike,
Bob G,
Gloria,
and Jessica, of course,
for enlightening us.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Oh, this is the best part.
This is Jillian's corner.
I noticed those dorm rooms weren't too neat.
It's so creepy.
Whose room is that?
Actually, I'm getting made fun of because apparently my room.
Oh my.
My room's like apparently like really dirty.
Oh my god.
Hi, how are you? We're doing a video project. We're wondering if we could interview you for like 1 minute. It's about science. You can just answer however you want. It's not a big deal.
Okay.
Is that okay? You can stay right there.
Okay.
All right.
Don't be afraid.
Yeah, go ahead.
Don't be afraid.
All right. Go. Yeah, you two. Just two people going because you don't want to crowd.
It's about biology. We love this stuff. All right.
Next question I'm going to ask you is, do you know who Bob Goldberg is?
Bob Goldberg, Jewish dude?
This is very good. Thank you very much. Thank you for your time.
Fair enough.
Name Bob Goldberg mean to you?
Nothing.
Nothing at all?
Never.
TA-29?
Nothing.
Sirius?
Nothing.
Now, tell me, first thing that comes to your head, Bob Goldberg.
The wrestler, but not exactly.
TA-29.
TA-29? No idea.
No idea. Do you think it might be responsible for saving India?
Sure.
Definitely. Bob Goldberg saves India.
You guys actually don't live like that in those dorms. Oh my god. Can't believe it. Jessica, where's Brandon? My menu's not coming up. There is no agenda. That's what I'm saying, there's no agenda. What did you just do?
Oh,
okay. If I could have your attention, we'll see if this one goes. Now, this is a new tradition that's... Jessica, don't go away, because you'll have more sophistication with this than I will. It's reading. Here it goes. Not good. No. Oh, it's a quick time. All right. So this is a tradition which now goes back about 4 years. And it started on a quirk of mine and has evolved into a whole production. And so, I'll get it. And so this is something that Jessica put together. And hope you enjoy it.
You know, I've never felt like this before.
The point here is that it's sort of like learning a foreign language by being plunged in and only speaking the foreign language as you go. And that's kind of the process that we use in this class. And so don't worry whether you understand it or not. I will promise you In fact, I will trade a month's salary with all of you. That by the end of the quarter, this article that you read for tomorrow that will see so complicated and so foreign that you'll say, what am I doing here, will be so easy and so trivial and so simple that you'll say, I don't understand how I couldn't understand it way back then, 10 weeks ago. Closely related species, one person says it's the same species, one says that they're cousins. What do you think? How many say different? Raise your hands high. Smile, Hannah. How many say different? How many say the same? Okay, Chris, I want you to come down here. Let's get Jennifer down here. Let's get Samir down here. Just a presence and a second guess, my sanity. Yes, it's a lesson, it's a base for my vanity. My tummy's up and that's when I see you get so hot. My common sense is out the door, can't seem to find the light. Take me, you know it's glad you feel it right. Take me on my clutch, just tie up in your arms tonight. I'm out with you, you got me head over heels. Boy, you keep me hanging on the way you make me feel. S.O.S. please, someone help me. Yes, help me, for me to feel this way. Oh, you are way on you. You got me tossing and turning, can't sleep at night. It's time, please, someone come and rescue me.
How old are you?
I'm 21.
And have you ever had a pregnancy before?
Once, yes.
Wait, what?
It was a long time ago. I was young.
You said you were
a
virgin.
It was a mistake.
And do you have any history of sexually transmitted infections?
Oh, please tell me. Sweetie.
I had chlamydia.
Let's get it on. Talk about that. And then sometimes people come in and they're just not having sex. So that happens. We don't do that or whatever. And other times they're not having it in the right place. So you just have to talk about how things work and how things are supposed to happen normally, and sometimes that's all they need. True. That's true.
The first is, what do you mean by not in the right place?
Yeah. Okay. No, not the location in the house.
Yeah.
Everywhere, yeah.
How many loci is that? Are you spending one?
13.
Or what's 13? Where are you getting that number from?
No, just from Harry Plant, the officer today.
Okay, so that's the general lead.
Yeah. Would that be more time consuming than doing fingerprinting, Karina?
Yeah.
Would it cost a lot more money?
Yeah, but you want to be sure.
Okay, well, we could do it either way. Well, let's say they're on a budget here. We're not going to sequence our whole genome. So what's the...
Regulators. Regulate any stealing of his property. We're damn good, too.
I'll kill you if you come near my house.
What's going on?
What are you talking about, Vincent? God!
Come on, punk!
No!
Mona, it was a clean.
Let me sterilize my tweezers. Do you have the sterilizer?
Just hit the east side of the LBC on a mission trying to find Mr. Warren G. Seen a car full of girls, ain't no need to tweet.
Since Valentine's is coming up, I have a little request. Roses are red, violets are blue, come back to bed, I really miss you. Always Sheila.
And the Sheila / Sugar Lips that is being referred to on this note is you.
No.
No.
That is not true.
This isn't your handwriting, Mrs.
No, that is forged.
This
is not mine.
Your signature.
No.
Are you aware of what perjury is, Mrs. Wong?
No.
It's when you...
Are you not?
Beloved friend.
So beloved might be an accurate characterization of your friendship. Now, I don't know because I've never had a friend, but it seems that you were really tied to this man, that you...
Mr. Melroy, how long have you known Vincent Wong?
Well, Editha, you know very well that Vincent, he was my best mate. And I met him as soon as I first came to UCLA. We were in the summer orientation program.
As I say regarding the DNA evidence, if the DNA evidence does not fit, you must acquit.
I'm tweaking into a whole new era. G-Funk, step to this, I dare ya. Funk on a whole new level.
The rhythm is the bass, whoa, and the bass is the treble.
Chords, strings, we brings melody.
Classical mating breeding techniques. One is that it's very slow because it has to work across generations. Another is that you can't pinpoint specific genes that you want to isolate. You can end up with other genes that get transferred along with it. You also can't do anything across species. It has to be things that naturally breed and mate. So here's an example for you. Let's say I wanted to breed this big leaf with this leaf to make even bigger leaves. The next generation might end up with a really little leaf. There's no way of knowing. That can happen. And that's just on one generation. But if you use DNA technology to genetically engineer things,
you can be far more precise.
What's a gene biologically?
I don't know that either.
Sure you do. You've heard about genes, haven't you?
Of course I have.
Okay, what have you heard about genes?
Scientific.
Tell me what you heard a little bit about genes.
Our,
brothers be like, how you doing, bro? When I'm cruising by, whenever I'm feeling lovely, I thank the Lord above me, and be like, and then we crack the bubbly. You see me at the bar, sitting with them fine women, sipping on that white wine, grinning while my time ticking. I'm thinking every girl got a little diamond, got a little diamond shine, and I'm taking time, get them. Means they all black in it. Maxing out the cards with the all black limit. Built my whole world from nada. Girls, we got a lot of them. Probably wanna be my baby's mama. Cause I'm a fresh kid.
Where's Jessica? That was great. God, Jessica's gotten so good at that, it's scary. I don't know why you have to give me such grief over it. It's excellent. 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 What I hope you've learned in this class is that teaching can be, and learning and education can be, a lot different than the usual cookie-cutter, cut-of-the-mill kind of education that one should not be getting at a university. I like to think back to one of my, you know, childhood heroes, and I remember hearing him talk when I was in graduate school many, many years ago, And he said, I'm paraphrasing a bit, he said, some men see things as they are and ask why. I dream things that never were and ask why not. And that's Bobby Kennedy. And that's what this class is all about. It's really about a dream of doing something that's totally different and not cut of the mill, and doing something which is really representative of a very different way of thinking and a very different way of educating and a very different way of teaching, because even though it may seem difficult and hard and painful at times, it's really student-oriented and it's really for all of you in terms of the educational process. And you saw today the end result of that, because it wasn't me that was answering these very sophisticated questions. It was you who understood and took all of this in and was able to conceptualize all of it. And so, in the final words that I have to say to you is that when you march out of here, as you all will, and move on, I want to just impart with you a little bit of the things that I told myself when I was your age, and I mean this. That was a long time ago. But it said, dream big dreams, and I mean that. And I said to myself, never look backwards, always look forward. Never, ever, ever, ever accept when someone says no to you. Always do what you want to do, not what you should do, and climb high mountains. And what you're seeing in this class is sort of the end result of all of that, of taking risks, because teaching a class like this, as well as taking a class like this, involves a big risk. But look at what comes out of it when we all work together and we all gather up our energies and we come up with something which is better than any of us could ever do. And so as you walk out of here, the most important thing that I hope you learn from this class is in one word, and that's excellence. That is not compromise on excellence whatsoever, because that's what moves the world forward. And now with the knowledge that you've learned, it's important for you to go out and talk to people about genetic engineering and cloning and stem cells and all the things that you've learned in this class. But when someone talks to you about it, you want to say, where's the data? What backs it up? What specific things do you have to substantiate what you're saying? Because what you've now learned, I hope, is to how to think critically about these issues. And being able to think critically about these issues means that you can go out and make a lot bigger contributions to society than others or perhaps I have. And so one of the things that I want to leave you with is that what I try and teach in all of you and all of my students is that I hope that all of you can be able to have your dreams fulfilled as I have, but I hope that all of you can accomplish thousands of times more than I've been able to accomplish. Because really the future is so much more in your hands. And so I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart from really being a great, great class and putting up with going to the board and all of the things. But what you can see is from the discussions, from the teamwork, from the take-home exams, from the guest lectures, from the dinners, from all of this came, I think, an experience that all of us have had, you and myself and TAs and everybody, that I think hopefully when you look back will be memorable, not only in terms of your education, but something that you will remember here at UCLA. And so I want to wish you all the best. The one thing I tell all of my classes is once your professor, always your professor. You can walk in my office anytime you want, but please come back and let me know how you're doing. And now let's go and share some cake, and Jessica's got some things for you to do. But thank you very, very, very much, and good luck. Tell them to write things down on there afterwards. First do the official thing, and then... So if you can just indulge us here. We have to have this unfortunate or fortunate paperwork, and any of your constructive comments would be very, very, very useful. I'm going to check the cake out.